Welcome to the Yeshiva Shalmaila. This is David Lichtenstein. We're going to be speaking about the corona vaccine. Should you be taking it? Are you allowed to take it? Your average vaccine, historically, has taken between 5 and 15 years to develop. This was done in 9 months. Well, they must have cut corners. They have no clue as to what the long-term risks are. I mean, what happens if in 5 years people start waking up and they grew horns? Are you allowed to take it? Or alternatively, do you have an obligation to take it? It's a chashash rachik ma'id that anything can go wrong with the vaccine. Corona is killing 1 out of 1,000 Americans. If you end up in the hospital, there's a 5% fatality rate, that 5 out of every 100 who end up in the hospital end up morbidly sick. So are you mechuyev to take it? What happens if you're safe? You're one of those lucky, you're 18-year-old, you're 20-year-old. The chances of you being negatively impacted are de minimis. Do you have to take it? I don't want to put myself in this risk. Or you may not get sick if you take it, but you could be a carrier and get a lot of other people sick. So I'll say, Samad El Damriyecha, you have to take it. Can the yeshiva say, listen, we have a safety policy here. If you don't take it, we're not accepting you back. Does the yeshiva have a right to make such a policy? What about, are you allowed to jump the line? You're supposed to get it in February because you're relatively healthy, but you own a nursing home and there are extra doses. Can you say, I'm going to take one for myself? Are there any dinim of kedima? We'll have from Philadelphia, there's Kan Rosh Yeshivas in America, Goyen Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, B'nan Shal Kedoshim, where he gives us the honor of a few minutes of his time. We'll have from Rav Shivas, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and Rav Hershel Shechta, who will answer all these difficult shailas halachically. By the way, he is one of my favorite guests, I do admit, because many Rabbanim beforehand, they ask, can I see the questions in before? I need a week to prepare. Or there's a Rav Hershel Shechta, I call him up, I'll say, Rav Hershel, can you speak about Chalitza Psula? So he says, yes. He says, do you want to understand how the second Teretz of Tosfos stims with the Maram Shif or not? Or if you ask him about Oilus Keitz HaMizbeach, he'll say, do you mean the Machlokes, the Bach, and the Pirish, how to learn Pshat in the Pirish HaMizbeach? So it's astonishing. So he makes my life very easy. And I do have a day job, so I need, you need Gainim like this on, who you can reach out to. We're going to have the most educator, the greatest educator of doctors in the United States, Dr. Alan Kadish. He's the president of Turo. I think he said he has over 3,000 doctors, future doctors, in his 5 medical schools, 4,000 health professionals in his dental schools, in his PT schools, OT schools, pharmaceutical, nursing, Fregnish. So there's no other school in the United States, no other president who has so many physicians under him. So he has his reach in the medical field to the people who have the information is unrivaled. And then we will have a guest for the first time, I think, on radio, on our podcast, Dr. Jeffrey Banda. He's a brilliant Talmud of Yeshiva, Harvard, MIT. He's the head of, he's leading Mount Sinai's COVID medical drive. He's had, literally, they've had thousands of patients there. He has a big community in Williamsburg that go to him, etc. And an absolute rock star, but maybe the biggest expert hands-on in COVID in the United States. So we have really a very wonderful list of guests. Should be a very interesting program. Rabbeisai, what are your thoughts? 732-806-8700, press number 2. That's for what the B'nai HaYeshiva have to say. Or info@headlinesbook.com. We will post both messages, voicemails, as well as written, unless you request otherwise. But we're interested in what the Olam has to say. Before we go to that, I want to talk something about the Parsha. We just left Chanukah. So sad. So sad how I look forward to Chanukah. And here's the question. What's the takeaway from Chanukah? Every Yom Tov is supposed to leave us with a certain oyer, with a certain enlightenment, a certain varmkeit. What can we take away from Chanukah? I want to share with you a thought. One of the greatest fears we have as parents is children going off the derech. I have friends, sadly, who have kids, Rosh Hashivas, who have kids who went off the derech, and not Rosh Hashivas too, who the pain that it extracts, their hair becomes white, their eyes become wrinkled. It's to them, it's arguably almost as painful as losing a child, in a certain disease. It's remarkable. And it's not just my friends or, people I know. It says by the obvious, Vayecherad Yitzchak charada gedoyel ad moed, the Medrash says, 2 times Yitzchak had a terrible fright. One when he almost went up during the Akedah. That was the second one is when his son came in, when Esav came in, it says Gehenim walked in, the fires of Gehenim entered the doorway with Esav. She says, which fear is greater, the fear of dying al kiddush Hashem or the fear of a child going OTD? It says charada by both. Ve'en yodeya eze gedoyla. And that's what it says, charada gedoyla ad ma'id. When Esav walks in, that fear was ad ma'id, of child going off the derech. In fact, Yaakov Avinu, right before on his deathbed, he says, Shema ein belibchem, maybe one of you has gone OTD. That was Yaakov's fear on his deathbed. And they said, Shema Yisrael Saba, Rashi brings in right here. So it's certainly a great fear. Why is it relevant to Chanukah? Well, for two reasons. You know, Chanukah is about the war of cultures. Paras Umadeh was basically a bunch of fressers. You know, Hashtia Kados Ein Oines. What was Paras Umadeh? Achashverosh and his harems. That's one type of opposition Klal Yisrael comes to. But the Hellenists, right, the Olympiads, Aristotle, who the Rambam calls Chacham Karav L'Nevuah. This is Western culture banging at our door. This is the Ivy League universities. These are the four horsemen, Hitchens and Hickens, etc., right, and Harris, right, the Kofrim, ones who wrote all those books. This is really a Lebedik Yetz Hara right by our door. That's the foreign culture that, you know, Chanukah, we defeat with Chanukah, with the Neris Chanukah. And the Ramban Taka says, Vatika Bekaf Yerech Yaakov, he says Yaakov himself was indomitable. Yaakov's Amuna, Tzurasei Chakuka Bekisei HaKavid, the faith of the Avos, the Avos Heinen HaMerkava, but Vatika Bekaf Yerech Yaakov, the archangel of Esav saw, he says, with Yaakov I'll get nowhere. But the Kaf Yerech is the hip and the groin. So the Ramban says, Zu doirei shel shma, the hidden by the mokim haleda. I can't defeat you, Yaakov, but boy, can I go after your children. Doirei shel shma, all those kids listening glued to the internet, to Instagram, to Justin Bieber and whoever, etc., today's adolescent heroes are. That is doirei shel shma. And Ramban says, that is Chanukah. That is our. So now is the time to talk about how do we combat the doirei shel shma. The Esachi, Es Esav, the embrace of Western civilization that is causing a 70% intermarriage, Rahman al-Islam. Let me share with you, if the secret is in Chanukah, right, if Chanukah represents the battle, there has to be something there that's relevant to us. The lach of Chanukah is Neir Ish Ubeisai. You light it outside, but it's Ish Ubeisai. In other words, if you're not home, if you're by a chasen and they set up, you know, 15 menorahs outside, you can make a bracha, asher kedushanu achfreilichem purim. You're not yoytze Chanukah candles. It's only ner ish ubeisai. There was one or two exceptions, you know, arguable exceptions, like lighting in a public square, maybe does it have a dinner beis haknesses for the masses, but on an individual, for sure, it's ner ish ubeisai. What does that mean? It's the household. Taka the sfardim, the father lights for everybody. How is your household? I mean, do you have like a warm Chanukah experience? Are there latkes? Are they playing dreidel? Are there gifts on Chanukah? Is there Chanukah guilt? What is your beisai look like? And why do I say this? Around 300 years ago, 250 years ago, there was a tzaddik in the town of Lechavichi. It's 25 miles west of Kletsk, where Baron came from there. This is way before him, though. And 25 miles south of Baranovich. You heard of these cities. The tiny town of Lechavichi had a tzaddik, Reb Mordechai Yaffa, an enikel of the Lavush, and he lived right after the era of Shapsi Tzvi. The Jews were broken. It was shattered. Shapsi Tzvi, a great Jewish leader, converts to Islam, right? The advent of Hasidus, and he struggled. And one day, a farmer walks into him, and his Hasidim are surrounding him. And the farmer says, Rebbe, can I ask you a question? An ignorant farmer, there was no yeshivas there. Day schools, yeshivas. He says, I learned in the parasha this week, it says, B'ayin Shalom tells Noach, B'ayata ishtecho b'necha el hateva. So this Amoret soul says to him, how did you, Noach, his wife and his children, walk into a word? Because a teva in Hebrew means a word, also as well as a box. He misunderstood. He said, I didn't understand pshat, and, you know, how do you read the pasuk? And all the chassidim started laughing, people around. And the Lechavitcher grabbed his head. And he stood still, and he was deep in thought. And he says, ah, such a deep thought, such a deep thought. He says, in times of great winds in the world, times of turbulence, and Sturm und Drang, and certainly was that the Der HaMabel, what does it say? It was, you know, Rashi says, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, etc. All these things, right? He said, there's only one way to save yourself from the winds of the world. And you know what that is? Enter, take you and your wife, your children, into a teva, into a dialogue, into a conversation. Create a real, what does a dialogue mean? Not a speech, that's not a dialogue. Conversation means where there's give and there's take and there's discussion and there's bonding. Ne'er ish u'beisai, if you can create, if you realize that the beisai, ne'er ish u'beisai, is the most valuable thing. And why do I say that? Do you notice the no daraisa, Mishnah Berurah is aimed on this, and Tafresh Ayin or Ayin Aleph, because you don't sell your tzitzis. You don't sell your shirt to buy tzitzis. Tefillin, go without tefillin. If you don't afford it, you're an oinus. Chanukah, you have to. Why? Because near the power of the beisai, near ish ubeisai. Take your, light a candle together with your family. And by the way, there's only one thing that near Chanukah, if you, near Chanukah, which comes before all the mitzvahs, before Kiddush Hayoyim, etc., the only mitzvah you have to, that in Da'alt Kaisa, you have to sell your shirt for. There's only one thing that is greater than Ner Chanukah. And what is that? Ner Shabbos. What is Ner Shabbos about? Shalom Bayis. The great mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, Ner Ish U'Beisai, there's one thing greater than that. Shalom Bayis. A happy home. If you love your children, make the only way if you want to have good children, love your wife. The Beisai is surrounded. The Beisai is the foundation of Ner Ish U'Beisai is Shalom Bayis. Ner Shabbos comes before. You know, the Ramban, Allah Torah, says that there is no mitzvah. All the mitzvah are derech hateva. There's one mitzvah that's derech nes. And what is that? The meham orim of Saita. When we give the bitter herbal drink to the Saita, that if she didn't sin, there is now Shalom Bayis is reestablished. It's the only mitzvah that's derech nes. Because for the Jewish family to create the foundation of Yiddishkeit, the first mitzvah in the Torah, celebes avay celebayis, the power of the family is so mighty, it's bederech nes. It's so mighty, sell your shirt. It's so mighty, Ner Shabbos comes before everything. And you know, this week's Parsha, Yosef, he's 17 years old. He sold down the river, one of the greatest crimes in history. The Navi says, Al Shloisha Pishei Al Arba Veloy Eshivenu, the unforgivable sin. It puts it next to the Chet Egel, selling of the brother. Now, somebody sold down the river. You would say, listen, look what the Orthodox have done to me. You see the footsteps, the way they talk about Yiddishkeit, Rahman al Itzlan. Look what the religious have done to us. Yosef, he's 22 years on himself in the flesh part of the world, in the house of Potipharah. Mitzrayim was the flesh pot, shtufei zima, like no other nation. And Yosef retained his holiness. How does he do it? I'll tell you how. I'll tell you the secret. Yosef is also indomitable. You know why? Yaakov loves Rachel. Yaakov is Rachel. He loves her. He loves Rachel. And Yaakov loves Yosef. Yisrael ohav es Yosef mikol banav. A child that comes from a union of love, who's beloved by his parents, he's indomitable. The flesh pots of Mitzrayim, Eishes Potipharah can't entice him. He is strong. It says Vayimoyin, last week's parasha, one of the four shalshelos in the Torah, Vatiso Eishes Adonav es Einel El Yosef, the seductress. The beautiful woman, she lifts her eyes to Yosef. Vatoimer shichfa imi, lay down with me, vayimoyin. So Rashi brings, how did he have the strength to the vayimoyin? So Rashi says he saw dmus yuknei shalaviv. He saw the visage of Yaakov in front of him. Now some say it was a mara hanavuah, some mechreinim say, but I heard a beautiful pshat. No, not at all. Mara hanavuah don't help us, Litvax. There's one other time in the Torah it says vayimoyin. It says vayavoyu toraf toraf Yosef. Yosef was torn to shreds. Here's his bloody clothing. It says, "Vayavayu kolbanu v'bnayisav anachmai vayimoyin milhis nachem." For 22 years, Yaakov sat shiva, and the Rechaim says they told him, "Vayavayu kolbanu v'bnayisav." He says, "Where were his? He had daughters-in-law. And what divrei nechama did they say?" So he says it refers to the beautiful families they made, the banav and his daughters-in-law. They said, "Look, there's so many of us. So one got lost. Okay." That's enough. That's the Divrei Nechama. One went. Look at all of us. There's 11 other children, their wives, their grandchildren. But Yaakov was so, he loved Yosef so much. Vayimoyin melis nachem. So it's a hekish vayimoyin vayimoyin. If you love your child so much, don't you think he'll feel it? Kimayim panim o panim. Child knows when we love them without question, without judgment. If you could be mekayim vayimoyin melis nachem, when your child is at some place in life, Vatisha Eshes Adoinov, and it could be a woman, it could be money, it could be power, it could be celebrity. Who knows what the Eshes Adoinov of that moment is? It could be drugs. If you want him to be Vayimoin Milis Nachem, you have to be Bekayim the first Vayimoin. If you want him to be Vayimoin Vayona Sachutza, you have to be Bekayim. How much love do you really put into him? Vayimoin Milis Nachem. So if we want to combat the Hellenists of today, the attack of the internet, Ner Ishu Beisai, Ner Chanukah, Vayimoyin Milahis Nachem. There's a Christian writer, Bengston. He wrote a book called Families and Faith. The Catholic Church put him, they're losing so many, they said, why do some families retain their religion? And he wrote an entire book. It was a decade study, followed families. And he said the one deciding factor whether children stay in the fold, he wrote this for the church, he says, what was the relationship between the parents and the child? Was it a family filled with love? You know, Dr. Pelkowitz told me a story. He goes every year to the Holocaust. He deals with PTSD. He's one of the great experts in the world. They fly him around. He said there was one old gentleman ready now. He must be 90s. He shines. He says he radiates, you know, positivity, confidence, warmth. So he said he sought him out from so many of the survivors were broken, were angry. And he said, what's your secret? And he says, I'll tell you my secret. He says, I remember the last death marches. The Russians were coming. They didn't want to see us, find us. I weighed 80 pounds then. He said, and every time I thought I was going to fall, I remembered every Friday night, my father would bench us. He would wrap his hands around my head, and I could feel the warm breath on my cheek as he benched me and he hugged me. And he said, every time I was bekiloyin kaychi, my father's breath, I would feel that on my face. And I would go another step. And what did the Gemara say in Shabbos and Daf Chav Beis? Hazohir b'ner. Somebody who is careful about ner. He's assiduous. He's punctilious. He makes havele banim talmidei chachamim. Now what does it mean hazohir b'ner? He lights the candle, gets the biggest wick, the best oil. I don't think it. I think the message of the ner. So why does Rashi say which ner? Ner Shabbos and ner Chanukah. Was your ner Chanukah about Ner Ishu Beisai? Was your Ner Shabbos about Shalom Bayis? Do we call our children every day, even if they're learning in Eretz Yisrael, even if they're in different cities and different time zones? Can we do a better job of being Mekayim Devayimoyin Melis Nachem so that our children are Mekayim when they have Dir Vatisa Eishas Adonav, whatever it may be today in today's modern world, today's Hellenistic driven society, that they should be Vayimoyin? What's our takeaway from Chanukah? Ner Ishu Beisai. But it doesn't have to stop on Chanukah. We have phones, we have hugs, we have kisses. If we want to be Mekayim, if we want to take away from Chanukah, the Bimasakin, the Vatika Bekaf Yerach Yaakov, that's the message of Chanukah, how we can do it. Now let's go to our riddle of the week. You know, last week we had 8 riddles. We said we were going to give the winner $250. We had a lot of fabulous answers, but there was a brilliant Talmud Chacham. I don't know who this fellow is from. It's a 347 in New York area code, but really it sounds like a Chassidish Yigaman. Really nailed it. I mean, I can't say I agree with all his terutzim, but they're all wonderful terutzim. You could dingzach on this and that. And where he's going to be the winner of our $250 lottery, we're going to call him up and send them a check. The winner of last week's riddle is Rabbi Avram Pollack. I don't know who he is, but he's obviously a real Talmud Chacham who knows Hilchas Chanukah, Hafach v'Yasher. He answered all 8 questions. Obviously, you're going to agree or disagree with some of the answers, but for the most part, he really, you know, brings good raya to each one, Makairis, Svaris, and he won the He won the $250 award for the best answers. We had a number of big Talmidei Chachamim who sent in answers for everything, some in voicemails and some biksav. We were going to put them all up. But the winner for this week, or at least Laniyas Daitenu, is Rabbi Avram Pollack. From his phone number, looks like from New York. Here is our riddle of the week. Vayikra Yosef is Shem HaBechor Menashe. He called it himself. Yaakov has 12 children. You don't see that he named even one of them. Sir, he's not his Bechor. His wives named all the children. Why is it by Yaakov's the wives got the names, and by Yosef, he's the one who named his son, Ben HaBechor? I'll ask one more riddle. The Vayomer Yaakov Labanov Lama Tisro. The Daskenimir says, Yosef did not tell his father Shuba Mitzrayim because they made a shvua and they were mishtatev the Kaddish Baruch Hu in the shvua shaloi legalis, whatever that means. But it was a shvua not to be megala. Question is, why isn't it a shvua levatal as a mitzvah? Because why? He was bittel the mitzvahs kibud of aim because his father was mitzayir so many years, 22 years. His father, Ani Yosef, look what you did to him. And what's the halacha? Nishba levatalis ha-mitzvah, loichal shvuasei klal. So how could the Rishayim, Daskenim and Balei Tosfos say? The reason Yosef didn't send a messenger up from Mitzrayim to inform his father he was alive was because of the shvua levatalis ha-mitzvah is not chal. Those are our two riddles of the week. As always, if you'd like to send in a comment, 732-806-8700, and for comments it's 2. Or you can email us info@headlinesbook.com. We do put up the comments and the letters online where readers or listeners can access them unless you request otherwise. Let's go to our wonderful guests. Our first guest is Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Gaon Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky from Philadelphia. He takes a cautious approach and he says, ask your doctor. Many people have immune diseases that they may have medication that creates conflicts. And he was cautious. He was saying, ask your doctor whether you should be taking these vaccines or not. Here's Rav Kamenetsky.
Shalom Aleichem. This is Rosh Yeshiva?
Yeah.
Shalom Aleichem. This is David Lichtenstein. I wanted to ask Rosh Yeshiva, if I have the opportunity to take the COVID vaccine,
yeah,
I'm over 60, which means I'm, whereas if I was a child, it wouldn't be so relevant to me, but at 60, I'm sort of, they say you should be chayshish ready, should I or shouldn't I take it? Because I've been sort of not going near my grandchildren now since March.
Oh.
And it's the isolation.
You'll be able to go?
I'll be able to go, yeah.
So it's good I should take.
Now, I want to ask Rashid one more question. In most matters, people follow doctors. If the doctor says take erythromycin, you take erythromycin. Penicillin. If the doctor says go for an X-ray, would the COVID vaccine fall under the same thing, like you follow what the doctor says?
There is the new vaccine you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, everybody said the new vaccine is not so sure.
So if your doctor says...
The testing period. Testing it on you.
And so in how long would Rosh Yeshiva say that it's absolute?
Probably takes a year.
Now, if your doctor says take it, should you follow your doctor like you follow him on strep throat, on penicillin, on broken bones, on chemotherapy? I mean, do you follow doctors?
You have a special doctor for that. You follow whatever the doctor says?
In other words, if your immunologist or whoever you are says you should take the vaccine, should we follow the doctor's advice?
Normally you should, unless there's a reason not to.
And would that be the same case here?
I guess so.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Rosh Yeshiva, for his time.
You're very welcome. All the best.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Now here's Rabbi Herschel Schacht, Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. He's going to answer the questions. He's also, we're going to ask him an interesting question, which I did not ask Shmuel Kamenetsky, was when do you ask your Rav and when do you ask a doctor? In other words, if your Rav says take amoxicillin and your doctor says take ampicillin, who do you listen to? Like, should a Rav be paskining on vaccines? That's going to be one of the questions we're going to ask. Here's a going to Parashal Shechta.
Shalom Aleichem, Afreilecha, Panaket Rashiva.
Hi, Shalom Aleichem, yes.
So I wanted to ask you, Kama Inyanim Bahalacha. So we all know that the coronavirus vaccine has arrived in the stores, so to say. And over the next 30, 60, 90, 120 days, everybody's going to get their chance in a line. Are you obligated to take the vaccine or not?
I think each person has to consult his doctor. There could be some specific reason why some people are not allowed to take it. Could be, I'm not a doctor. But if the doctor feels that it's appropriate, I would think that it's an obligation for two reasons. First of all, we have to protect ourselves. And secondly, we have to protect everybody else. Even if we personally are not nervous, there's a principle of Shem Epsayim Hashem. If they have a suffix akana, there's no one near 50-50. So if one is personally not nervous, he doesn't have to worry about it. But there are other people who are nervous. And the doctors say that if you don't have something like 70% of the population in the country vaccinated, then we're not going to succeed in getting rid of this magefa. So we have an obligation to take it for ourselves, to take care of our own health. And even if we personally are not nervous, we have an obligation to protect everybody else who is nervous. Yeah, I would think so.
So, Marshall, the incidence of danger for, let's say, people in their 20s or teens is really very remote. It's one in 100. It's very remote. So you would say that even if they're not worried about themselves, they would still have to do it because they can be carriers and infect other people.
Right, they can transmit it to someone else, yeah.
Now, where do we find in halacha, it's sort of like the Nishmarta Minor, do we find in halacha the concept of preventative, like vaccinations, for the most part, they're a little more than 100 years old or so. So the concept of preventative medication in the Shmartim L'Oidl Nafshim is somewhat uncommon. Would Rashiv agree with that?
Yeah, but they talk about it in Shulchan Aruch. They write in Hilcha Shabbos, it says, when the German government put the Maharam Rutenberg in prison, he didn't do anything wrong, but they just wanted to hold up the Jewish community for the ransom money. So he wasn't a criminal, so they allowed this Talmidim to come. So the Talmidim came every day, and they spoke and learning. So when they came on Shabbos, and it was cold in the wintertime, they would ask the guards to please make a fire so they wouldn't get sick. So we allow Amir al-Nachri for a Chol Hashem Sakana, for one who already is a Chol Hashem Sakana, to drive him to the hospital to treat him. And we allow Amir al-Nachri to prevent one from becoming a Chol. That's what the lotion that they formulated was. It's cold, so that everyone can catch a cold. So everyone has the status of a Chol Hashem Sakana to prevent them from becoming a Chol Hashem Sakana. Yeah, all the coolest for Chol Hashem Sakana apply whether he already is a Chol or to prevent him from becoming a Chol.
And I would just be myself to what Rashi was saying is you see that in Yeredeya Kuf Tezayin, it says that a person should run from a city as soon as he hears a dever. That would only be preventative.
Sure.
And yet we see that there's a chiyuv, and I believe the Magen Avraham brings it in Tafkuf Ayin Vav, the same thing, that we should run at the Mishnah Berurah as well. That we should run. So you see the concept of preventative medication. Now what about a school? You have people who are anti-vaxxers, and I don't want to go into whether it's correct or incorrect, but so you're sending kids to school, and you inoculated your kid, and you find out that there's a number of students in the class who their parents didn't want to be inoculated. Can you demand of the school to say, listen, they don't have a right to send their kids and put my kid at risk, even though it's a remote risk, because your child is inoculated, but there is some percentage he could still get sick. Does the school have a right to say, I'm talking about a community school, say, listen, if you don't want to get inoculated, bavakasha, keep your kid at home and teach him or not?
I would think that the school does have the right. Every school has to set their policies. This is a policy to see to it that all the children should be safe. The generally accepted position by all of the overwhelming majority of the real doctors in the world is that this vaccination is a healthy thing.
Yeah, I believe, by the way, that there was a tshuva from Rebbe Yashiv where he said the same thing. He said that they could, it's Mipi HaShmu, I saw it in the Chaveres Halacha L'Maisa. He said that if most of the children in a class are, and some parents don't, they could ask from those to say, listen, get vaccinated or else.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Go to a different school.
And the question is, I mean, the Gemara in Sanhedrin brings that Kolir Sheimba Saradvarim Halalu. One of them has to be. There are Takana Seir. Bezdin has. You have to have a Bezdin. You have to have a Kupachol Staka. You have to have. And you have to have a doctor.
Roman. Yeah.
So the question is, would those Takana Seir go to the level of? The same concept of you see that a city has the right to enforce certain basic health concepts, such as a roife, would that fall into this obligation?
I would think that it does, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. By the way, to my knowledge, I don't think immunization, given that it's so recent, I don't think there's much about Shuvas in the Paiskim. I think the closest thing we have is that Yachin Abayas, no?
I'm not familiar. What does the Yochanan Bayez say?
Yochanan Bayez talks about, in the Bayez, he says, you're allowed to take inoculation for smallpox.
Uh-huh.
Because he says, Yemuta, he says, even though you think there may be a danger, he says, because, Rashoy lahachnis atzmoy besakana rechoyka, lahatzel atzmoy mesakana kreva.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's interesting because if somebody could make the argument, what right do I have to be machnas myself into a suffix sakana, no?
But the doctors recommend it. They say that the gain outweighs the risk.
Okay, so I was asked the following, Shiloh. Somebody told me he works in a nursing home, and he has access to vaccines already this week. The first inoculator. So somebody came over to me and said, listen, I'll give you $1,000 if you could get me into the first patch. He says, where are you? He says, I'm a healthy 50-year-old, but I'm just a pachtin, and I would like to jump the line. I'm supposed to get, they're going to make it available to the general tzibur in February, the end of January. He says, is there any ethical, halachic issue with saying, I am going ahead of, I'm jumping the line, in other words, because ultimately if 10,000 people did it, that means 10,000 older people in nursing homes wouldn't do it. Does a person have a chiyuv to say, look, I'm loisamed al damar yecha maybe of the old people in the nursing home? What does he have a right to say? But I have a right to look out for my own well-being. What would Rosh Yeshiva say to that, Shiloh?
I would think that the Gemara and the Mishnah and the end of Harius are to say the kedimas when a lot of people are bisakone who has kedima. So we don't follow that say the kedimas. Whatever the reason is, doesn't apply Bisman as that. But you see from the Mishnah, there is such a concept that there should be a Seder Kedimus. So here the government determined what the Seder Kedimus is. All the people in nursing homes and so on, and the doctors who treat the patients in the hospital and so on, the nurses. So there's a Seder Kedimus, and that's you're supposed to follow that Seder. Like in the days of the Mishnah, they had that Seder Kedimus, so we have a different Seder. I would think it's not proper to bribe someone to jump the line.
Would he be over on Loisamed al Damariecha of potentially putting somebody at risk?
I would think that yes. You're not allowed to violate the Seder Kedim.
Okay. Let's say somebody has a vaccine. Let's say you have a nursing home, they have the vaccines, and they got extra.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the somebody wants to take it. He owns the nursing home, he wants to take it, even though he's not at risk or anything. But he could also give it to somebody, he could donate it to another older group of people. Would you say that there's a chiv on him to give his excess to the other people, or since he already owns it, he could take it himself?
I would think he may take it. If they sent him so many and he has left over, so then I would think he may take it. I'm a chiv to volunteer if he has it already.
Would there be a din of like a val yavazvez? In other words, also din of loisamid, he should have to give up more than
I think he have the right to take it himself. He's not jumping the line over here. He followed the Seder Kedimus, and he has left over. Okay.
Now, the din of lines, in the Kedimus, is that ethical? Is that like, is that Chosh Mishpat? Is that Yeridea? Where would Rosh Yeshiva put that?
I would think it's in Yeridea. You say Kuf Tezai, but not to put yourself in Sakana. and to everyone should be Naig, according to the... It happens to be that it's in the end of Chosh Mishpat, but it really belongs in your day.
Yeah, in Tav Chavav. If somebody is a very big pachtan, and they're very worried about vaccines, any heter for them not to take it?
Yeah, okay. If he's nervous, okay. But we should try to convince him he shouldn't be nervous. If all the major honest doctors in the world say that this has helped save the world from all the different epidemics, from all the different sicknesses, so it has been established that vaccines work.
So last child of the Rosh Hashiva, everybody's running to the Rosh Hashivas to hear whether they should take the vaccine or not. Is it a shaila of das Torah or is it a shaila of medicine? Like if the doctor would tell you, you have to eat so-and-so to feel better, or you have to take penicillin, do you go to the doctor to ask the penicillin, or do you go to your Rav, and is it analogous to this or not?
You go to your doctor, and then the Rav should say, you have to listen to the doctor. That's what the Tanoim and Amaroim. They were not doctors. The Chassam Sofer writes in a tshuva. They used to take the word of the Goyisha doctors. They themselves were not. They didn't have Halacha Moshe Messina and all these things. But whatever the doctors of their generation said, that's what they would follow. So the Rabbanim should say that to their Talmidim, to their Balabatim, they're mechuyif to listen to the doctors. We should follow in the footsteps of the Tanoim and Amoraim. They were always on the, they were following the doctors who were on the cutting edge of medicine. Because medicine, every couple of years, they keep on discovering something new. Everything keeps on changing in medicine. If a doctor's going to practice medicine today the way he did 5 years ago, they'll take away his license. 5 years ago, they didn't know anything. Every 5 years, they come up with a new chidush, and everything's in ganzen different. So the Rabbanim should tell the Balabatim, they mechuyif to follow the doctors. That's what the Tanaim did. They all followed the doctors of their generation.
Where do you see that? Where would Rosh Hashiva give an example?
What do you mean? All the medicine in the Gemara. So the Chassam Sofer says that it wasn't Halacha Moshe Messina. They picked it up from the Goyish doctors in their generation.
Does Rosh Hashiva have anything else important that he thinks to be Moshe for this topic?
We should all be Mispalo. That we should all be Nitzal.
Amen. Amen. Thank you very much.
Should all be healthy. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Now we'll speak to Dr. Alan Kadish, who's the president of Turo, and it's 19 schools, including 5 medical colleges. He has something like 3,000 or 4,000 doctors under him in training in the 5 schools, as well as 4,000 medical professionals, health professionals in other fields, such as dentistry. They opened up the New Jersey Institute of Dentistry. They have pharmaceutical schools, every other school you could imagine. So he's really an expert. Like, he is the educator par excellence in the United States as far as knowledge of what's going on in medicine and reach. He can reach just about everybody because of his extensive networking. Here's Dr. Kadish.
I believe, Dr. Kadish, that you have more future physicians in your program than any other medical school in the United States. Is that correct?
Except if you consider all of the University of California together, we do.
Okay. All the medical schools in California as one school. You also
right.
have 4,000 other healthcare students. You have a dental school, pharmaceutical school, et cetera, et cetera. So it's fair to say, outside of California, you are the largest and certainly private university in the United States for medicine. Is that fair to say?
It is, absolutely.
Okay. So we would like to know, I know you just appeared on the cover of AMI, speaking about the COVID vaccine, and when I saw it, my question is that I imagine many of our listeners would be thinking, especially those that, you know, are a little bit cynical about, you know, medicine, the vaccine, et cetera, and they would be saying, look, you're a very famous physician, but you're not an epidemiologist or an infectious disease specialist, so, like, where are you getting your data from?
Turo and New York Medical College, which are part of our system, had our first COVID conference on January 31st. And since then, we've had monthly conferences and weekly discussions, and I'm able to get opinions from experts around the country who are part of our system in public health, in infectious disease, in microbiology and virology. And together, we discuss what's happening with COVID and what we should recommend to people. So I'm not representing myself. I'm representing an entire team of experts in a variety of different healthcare fields who communicate frequently, and the sort of opinions that I expressed in AMI magazine and the recommendations that I made are based on the collective wisdom of this group of experts.
So share with us, what were your conclusions?
the main conclusion is that the vaccines that either have been approved or are likely to be approved in the next few days, which is the vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna, both of which work in the same basic way, have been very highly effective with a very, very low incidence of serious side effects. And so let me give you some details about that. Both vaccines showed about a 95% effectiveness at preventing people from getting COVID. And they were both done as randomized studies. In the case of Pfizer, 44,000 patients. In the case of Moderna, almost 30,000 patients, where half the patients got the vaccine and half the patients got placebo. And they looked at how many people in each group were infected. And so in that those trials, and the results were pretty similar, even though the vaccines have some differences, about 95% effectiveness of the vaccine in preventing COVID. And just as with all vaccines, people had a little muscle ache, maybe a little feverish for a day after they got the vaccine. But there was probably only one really serious side effect that could potentially be attributed to the vaccine. And even that one patient, it's not absolutely certain that it caused the side effect. And that patient recovered. So remarkable safety data. The one exception that's been seen a little bit as the vaccine is rolled out in the community is that people who have allergic reactions to some components of the vaccine, which is rare, let's say have had an allergic reaction to vaccines before, they may be at risk for an allergic reaction. And so there's a very, very small group of people where there may be some risk. So far as I know, there's nothing been fatal or anything terribly serious. But that very, very small group of people might be at increased risk. But other than that, the vaccines were extraordinarily safe and extraordinarily effective. And the fact is, we know hundreds of thousands of people in the United States have died of COVID. People continue to die every day. And what we call in medicine the risk-benefit ratio is that how good it's going to be if you take it versus you don't take it. It's overwhelmingly in favor of taking the vaccine.
So here's my question, Dr. Kadish. Medicine has a long history of reversals too. Right, there are many drugs. Eli Lilly announced that solanezumab, its drug for Alzheimer's, 5 years into it, they were wrong. And most vaccines have historically taken, I don't think there's been a vaccine that was less than 5 years before this. So this is sort of, like you have the guys who date, they take the time and they date and they do it over, 2 months, 3 months. Then you have the guy, he meets a girl, the second date, they know it's it, the third date, they thing. And then 2 years later, they're sitting in therapy, she has, So how do we know that in 2 years from now, they're not going to come back and say, people, now we've discovered the vaccine creates heart issues. It's just, somebody grew a third eye in the middle of their forehead. I'm using this as a metaphor. They're introducing foreign proteins, all kinds of chemicals into people's systems on something that's 10 months old. How does medicine take the responsibility? And you would agree that there are many histories of failure in medicine that were discovered, years later, like the kids who took that, who ended up with all kinds of diseases. I forgot the name of that drug. How do you know this? How do you know that? I mean, by medicine going on to the cover of a magazine, it's a tremendous amount of achrayas. And how do you feel about that when somebody says, how do you compare that to those other cases?
So what I would say is this. First of all, you've raised two very, very good questions and two very, very important points. One is the speed in which the vaccine was developed. So what I would say about that is, remember, medical technology has been advancing rapidly. And the extent to which resources were poured into developing these vaccines has never been seen before. So the fact is, despite the fact that these vaccines were developed rapidly, they went through the stages of testing. And they had, as I mentioned, huge numbers of people who were exposed to the vaccines before they were sent to the FDA and deemed effective. And while there's some people who say the vaccine was fast, other people criticize the FDA because in Britain, they actually approved the vaccine 2 weeks before the FDA did. So the FDA, I think, has taken a very smart, middle-of-the-road approach to making sure they look at the data, making sure the vaccine is safe before they granted the emergency use approval to give the vaccine. So I think that what people should not focus on is the amount of time it took to develop because of the billions and billions of dollars in the advanced scientific technology which was poured into this, but rather how many patients were treated and what do the results look like. Now, the second point you raise, which is that any time you develop a new therapy, that you can never be absolutely sure what will happen years down the road. And of course, that's absolutely true. But I would make two points about this. One, we do have a long history of administering vaccines, and we've never seen late complications from vaccines. Sometimes, you know, there are some things that have caused some side effects that are seen relatively early, but we've never seen severe late complications from vaccines that have been verified or clear. So I'm relatively confident, one, that if there were side effects from the vaccine, that we would have likely seen them already. Can I be absolutely sure? Of course not. But let's look at the other scenario. Let's say we didn't use the vaccine. And we said, you know what? We're going to wait till we have 2-year follow-up on the people who took the vaccine in the clinical trials to be absolutely sure that nothing happens 2 years down the road. What would the consequences of that be? Likely, 100 million people would die, and many more would die from the disease, and many more would die from poverty and the economic disruption caused by the measures we need to take to control the disease. So I can't be absolutely certain that nothing will be seen because, as you're absolutely right, in medicine nothing is ever certain, and we've always been wrong about things, and certainly there's some early recommendations that were made about COVID pandemic before we had data that turned out not to be accurate. But any rational look at the idea that we would delay the vaccine for a couple of years versus the idea that we'd use it right away, it's hard to imagine that any side effects of the vaccine, which has been extraordinarily safe in clinical trials, could possibly approach the disaster that would happen if we continue without a vaccine.
And Dr. Kadish, I think that you're echoing what the Yochin Uboyaz, when he saw the first when the first vaccine came out, this is at the Paris Yisrael in Yuma in Perek Ches Mishneh Zayin, and he was asked about the being inoculated for smallpox. He says a person should be machnas himself rashoy lahachnas hasmoy the sakana rechayka kedei lahatzel atzmoy mi sakana kriva, and it was a distant, a remote risk, right? You should definitely, you know, go head to head with the impending current and very dangerous risk, then worry about a remote risk, a smaller chance at a later date. And that's basically what you're saying, the same idea.
I'm saying exactly what you just said. He was a tremendous Chalmud Chacham and very prescient. And I would add that we all accept the fact that when there's a medical therapy that's highly likely to succeed, let's say to treat cancer, even if it has some significant side effects, if the advantages of taking the therapy exceed the risks, most poskim say not only is it mutter to take the therapy, but you're required to take the therapy because of shmatam misnapshos echem. So I don't view this as any different. It's hard to imagine that any side effects of the vaccine could possibly approach the terrible things we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic, and that's why I'm very comfortable getting up anywhere and saying the right thing to do is to take the vaccine.
Now, let's say you're 20 years old, and you say, listen, the odds of something happening to a 20-year-old are so remote, I'm not taking the vaccine. Or why should I take the vaccine? How would you respond to that?
So I would say two things. First of all, what we've learned, and we have learned things about COVID as time has gone on, is that the odds of something bad happening to a 20-year-old are not so remote. There are, unfortunately, significant numbers. Yes, the risk is much less than if you're older, but there's a significant number of young people who've died. And perhaps more importantly, COVID affects not just the lungs, but it affects the heart and the brain. And we've seen people months later who still have evidence of lingering effects from COVID. We hope they will get better, but we don't know that. So this is not a benign disease, even for 20-year-olds. So that's point one. And point two is we have a responsibility to others as well. You can't say that you're responsible only for yourself. I'm going to let somebody else do it. There's a question in the old days when the walls of a city were important for the upkeep and safety. There's a halacha question. Can I say, let everybody else do it, and I'm non-responsible? And the halacha is no. You have to do your part for the community. And obtaining herd immunity is an important part of getting over this and getting life back to normal, having yeshivas and shuls open with no restrictions, a very important place we have to get to. And the quicker we achieve herd immunity, the quicker everybody gets vaccinated, the quicker we can get back to what we considered normal and be done with this. And so I think it's everyone's responsibility to play his part in this.
Well, Dr. Kadish, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure to speaking with you as always.
Now let's go to Dr. Jeffrey Bander. He's a Talmud of Yeshiva, Harvard, MIT. He's just an absolute brilliant doctor. He headed the COVID, assignment over at Mount Sinai. They've had you'll hear from him. He personally has touched over 500 patients, but he said they've had thousands of them. He is probably the number one expert just from a hands-on, or one of the top few in the United States. He's speaking, I saw, at the next Mount Sinai Forum. He has a lot of Frumma patients. He actually saved one or two friends of mine who were in Mount Sinai, really sick. So let's go to Dr. Jeffrey Bander.
Welcome, Dr. Bander.
Oh, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So, Dr. Bander, many of our listeners, I shouldn't say many, well, we have a lot of listeners, but some of our listeners certainly believe that COVID is a bluff, like one of them said. It's political, it was brought about by, you deal in the ICU, you see, is COVID a bluff? Is it real? Is it worse than the flu? I know this sounds very, I want to start at the bottom and work my way up. Is it really much worse than the flu? I mean, I was getting statistics, how many people a year die of flu? Give us from hands-on, somebody who deals with these people, what is it really like on the front lines?
So, it's really interesting how COVID is a very unique disease in that, even people who say that, everyone knows people, and especially in our community, who have died of COVID, who have been affected by it, who have been patients, even if they didn't die, who are, they got trached or in nursing facilities. So I don't think even those who face the bluff, I don't mean it's a bluff. I think they mean that not most people who get it aren't going to get very sick. And I think, I have a skewed perspective, and I can tell you, being in the hospitals in April when it was overwhelmed and you had ICUs filled with two or three patients in rooms that had one patient, it was a sight you would never in your life thought you could see in this country. It looked like a third world country at some points. So COVID is definitely not a bluff. And I think what makes people think about it and get confused about it is that so many people get COVID, and you're talking about elderly people, and they don't get sick. And they say, oh, you're elderly, you're diabetic, you're going to get sick. And a lot of people do not. And so even when you just have a small percent, 10, 5% of people who get COVID get very sick and require oxygen, and maybe only 2% of them require hospitalization, when you're talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, you're talking about thousands and thousands of people being very sick. And when it happens very quickly, the system gets overwhelmed. And even major hospital centers, when you surge a few hundred above capacity, these places are not built to staff up quickly. And so the amount of care you can get is really proportional to, how many patients are in. And so COVID is quite deadly. And if you are one of these unlucky, I compare it to almost like a Russian roulette. You don't know if you're going to be the one to really get sick. Are you that really unlucky 1 in 50 person that's going to get sick? But in the last, since Rosh Hashanah, I've treated 250 Orthodox patients in Mount Sinai who required oxygen. Many of them ended up on ventilators. A dozen or so have passed away. It's serious. And we're talking about people from the ages of 50 to 90. So we don't know who's going to be affected. It is very, very serious.
You say 12 have passed away out of 250, which is give or take 5%. So when people hit Mount Sinai, I mean, there's a 5% death chance. That's a significant number, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that that's a decent number, and I think that it also is proportional. When it was a few patients at a time, it's easier for us to keep eyes and treatment. But when the hospital, I can tell you proportionally, now as the hospital is getting busier, I think that there's a big surge in COVID going on. And as, it's no longer just, our other communities are having big surges. I think the Jewish community surged a bit earlier. But as the hospital's filled up now, the death rate does go up.
So let's go to the COVID vaccine. First of all, I'm sure you've been right in the forefront of this as one of the leading experts in the country in COVID. Tell us a little bit about the vaccine, and then let me ask you some questions about it.
So I think it's really important to have a little basic understanding of vaccines. First of all, we live in a community where, and in a time where people don't always trust things, and the news has questionable sources, and we've already have a certain segment of the population that's hesitant about vaccines. And what's happening here now is that vaccines are being made in a new way than they were done previously. And this is important to understand why. I think this is really key. The vaccines that we've been taking in the past that everyone's used to for the MMR, the measles vaccines, those are all viruses that were, modified so they weren't as harmful and your body would get used to fighting them. The new vaccines are made of a new technology where we're not actually introducing the virus. We're actually introducing proteins that are similar to the virus so your body can learn to fight the virus. We're not actually giving you the virus. And these new technologies allowed us to scale up vaccines much faster. So the new vaccines really are just going to teach your body to produce what's called the spike protein, which is what makes the virus attached to the body, and your body will produce antibodies against it. So that's just important to understand. This is a new way of making vaccines, and we're not giving people viruses. There's no mercury, thimerosal, none of these substances that people were concerned about in the past.
Dr. Bander, how do we know that in 4 years from now, and I'm going to use metaphors, people who take the vaccine are not going to grow a third eye on their forehead? I mean, we're introducing foreign bodies, messenger DNA, stuff that has never been used before, and very often the tale of what these things can actually affect could be years in the making. So like everybody's rushing into this, and how do we know that in 3 years it's not going to cause heart disease, kidney disease, memory malfunction, brain disease? I mean, and just like they have thalidomide, you have a generation later, all the kids who took this now have this. How could we say with any level of certainty that this, you can't have a billion people at some point saying, oh my God, what did we do to ourselves?
Right. So you're talking, this is a call in our community. I'm not going to stick to any sort of messaging. The answer always is it's a risk benefit for anything, right? So if I were to offer you a vaccine for cancer, right, to take it, that, not develop cancer, most people would take it. I don't think people say, oh, I'm going to take my risk, I think we know, at least all of us who've seen it, what COVID can do. And we're not talking right now about vaccinating children, right? We're talking about right now about vaccinating high-risk adults, right? So there's no reason to have ask the question, why do we think that these vaccines are going to cause these issues? There's no reason to think about it. It hasn't been shown to do that. So the vaccine technology that, for example, the mRNA technology is new. You're right. We don't know 100% what's going to happen, but there's no reason to suspect that it will. It's been studied now for other diseases. We use some of this technology in treating cancers when we do adenovirus vectors, and it hasn't been shown to have those effects. But I think you're right. I think we have to weigh what are we treating. Look at what's happening now. I mean, people who get COVID get definitely a look at what society has become in terms of social distancing and the economy. I think we have to weigh everything all together. But I would say COVID is deadly, and I'm going to take the vaccine. So you're right. We don't know four-year outcomes, right? But we do know from the data that we have on the vaccine now for the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine that, these are 60,000 people that were studied, and we've tried, send them out for 3 months now. But I don't know where the Haskama comes to ask why there's going to be in 4 years from now, cardiac disease or cancer.
Okay, so let me follow up then. I'm a 25-year-old, let's say. Or a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old, and I say, look, COVID's ability, my fatality possibility if you're 20 years old, I think 15 people in the United States under the age of 16 have died from COVID out of 300 million people, right? So the likelihood is of getting hit by lightning, of winning the lotto is bigger if you're 16 or now I'm 25, it's really remote, and I say, if I was in a nursing home, you say, look, it could have a bad effect in 5 years. I'm probably not going to be around in 5 years, so I'm much glad to take the low-hanging fruit, take the vaccine. I'm over 60 or whatever the cutting age is. I'm 25. Like, what do I have to enter into these sort of Russian roulette type of possibilities that maybe something will happen at a later date? I don't think it makes sense for me to take it. How would you respond to me?
Well, first of all, I would respond without trying to convince everyone is I think that, you know, before the vaccine is widely available to people like that, there's going to be 20 million healthcare workers and nursing home residents who will be vaccinated. And you're going to have real world data on that at least, you know, for 6 to 9 months, and we'll see how it goes. What I would say right now for hesitancy is that you're right. I think the risk-benefit calculation, everyone should be vaccinated. That's my official line, and I believe that. I think that it's as a public health issue and protecting others, we would like to, you know, eradicate this virus as much as possible so it's no longer circulating amongst us, and so that we can go back to normal society, normal, you know, gatherings, weddings, everything safely. And, you know, but I do agree that right now the people, the risk-benefit conversation, those who are elderly should get it. I think we can revisit that 25-year-old conversation in a few months and see how it goes. So let's focus on convincing those that should be vaccinated to be vaccinated immediately.
Okay. Now, another question. The virus appears to keep continually be mutating. They say there are over 1,000 variations, and in Europe there's a new variation that is spreading, like is much more potent in its ability to spread, needs less of a load. Is there a reasonable likelihood that you may get a vaccine, and in 9 months they say, wait, you need another vaccine for the newest variation of COVID, or do you think the vaccine will pretty much cover most of it?
You know, again, we don't know everything. I think that the way that this virus, you know, compared to MERS and other SARS viruses, the experts don't think that this virus is likely going to mutate to a form where our current vaccines don't work. This is not like the flu virus, which every year reorganizes and requires testing of strains. It's a different type of virus. This is a coronavirus, not an influenza type virus. So it behaves very differently. And even though it's a novel coronavirus, remember that's keyword is novel. It's novel for a reason because we don't know everything about it. But in terms of the way this spike protein works, is we do think likely, even if it does change and the way that the body responds to the vaccines probably will work. But again, I'll be completely honest with your listeners. No one can guarantee anything because it's novel. But we do know that in terms of the strains circulating out there right now, these vaccines are very, very effective. And if you look at the Pfizer and Moderna data, 95% efficacy. So those who received it, there were only very handful of cases of people who received the vaccine who ended up getting the illness. And of those, they didn't really have severe cases.
Okay, so doctor, so my takeaway is if you're anywhere in the, you have a comorbidity, you're somewhat older, et cetera, you should absolutely get it. If you're 25 years old, wait a few months, see what happens. Is that sort of the takeaway?
Well, I think that's just a practical takeaway, right? I think that we're not offering the vaccine to 25-year-olds. It's a logistics operation right now, getting this off the ground and running. I think certainly I really do feel, and I feel strongly for our community, that especially because we're not all following the social guidelines and we're not able to, right, as a community, and we're not able to do it. So protect our elderly. I think it's important to message them. If you're going to be going, continue life, get the vaccine if you're older than 65. Get the vaccine if you have any risks at all. No question. I think the risk benefit's a no-brainer here for adults.
Now, what about immunosuppressed people, people with allergies? Are there people who shouldn't be getting the vaccine?
So people with severe allergies should consult their doctors. We don't know. But look, anyone who gets a vaccine, there are going to be side effects. There's going to be people who develop, adverse events. It happens with every vaccine from shingles to flu. But I think that everybody, if you're immunocompromised, ask your physician based on what you're on. But yes, more likely immunocompromised people should get it.
Okay.
But remember, we're not introducing a virus. So there is zero chance you're going to get COVID from the vaccine. You're not sending a virus in you. And it's not changing your DNA.
One last sort of a question. I've heard from many people, and feel free not to answer this question, but I've heard from many people that COVID was so frightening to many of the physicians, nurses, et cetera, that the people in hospitals are getting, somebody said, my grandfather died and he wrote a note, I starved to death because nobody came into my room. I died of starvation. Or they're pulling the plug out on me against my will because they need the ventilator for somebody else. Do you believe these stories, or are these just a sort of horror stories that circulate that have no credence?
You know, every story often has some credence to it. And I think that in the surge, around Pesach last year, when hospitals were completely overwhelmed and we had no idea what we were doing. You know, I do think that, you know, people's care did suffer. I think hospitals did their best to try to figure out how to protect patients and staff, and I think staff was scared. But I think that, you know, that at the end, you know, again, I think that there, I will agree, there were lots of cases of people that did not receive optimal care, and that was because of lack of resources, lack of staffing, and just, you know, just kind of the fog of war.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dr. Bender, I know that you've treated a number of friends of mine, and thank God with successful outcomes with my friends, right? And I know that you've been literally in the trenches, you were the general for a great part of the Williamsburg community. So even though I'm not the shliach, you know, I'm zachel adam shleibefanav, and I want to give you a most heartfelt thanks for putting your own life at risk, your family's health at risk, on behalf of the chayli b'nei Yisrael, and in general, in the sick of the world as well.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's an honor. Everyone gets their call to do something good, and I'm just happy to be able to help people. And I just, you know, want to say one last thing is that there is so much we still don't know about this, and it's very unfortunate and very hard for people to understand. But, you know, this, you know, there are a certain subset of people that get this disease, and there's nothing that we know to do for them yet. And so we really still need to figure that out.
Thank you very much, Dr. Banda.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, Colton.